last week's Shaney and this week's Shaney is that Jonathan Mike, who's got a simcha today, but he mentioned the Mar Makom to me, which I wish I had remembered before last Thursday, because I definitely would have mentioned it. Now, last Thursday we had the somewhat difficult topic of talking about the mumin that's relevant to a kohen, and that was a topic of Shaney and Amor. And Jonathan mentioned that Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein has a discussion. I don't think he had access to the whole discussion because the discussion is printed in the Sefer, Harevna. And I think Jonathan has access to an email list where they tell you the shilas and they tell the answers later. So I think he had just seen the shiloh. But it's interesting to look at. It kind of connects the Shaney of last week and the Shaney of this week. And this is Chiluk Gimel. So the shaila is, if you were Rav Zilberstein's style in general, use these forum that have been published from him. I don't know who actually puts them together, but there is very often a somewhat unusual halachic question that is considered and is connected in ways that are not always necessarily so obvious to things in the parsha. So he discusses in the context of last week's parsha, we talk about the mumim, the pasuk, which says that the mumim are an issue for kohanim. So he makes reference to similar gemaras that appear in Maseches Bechoros, and that somebody is giving a daf yomi shir in Bechoros, and the shir was about to get up to the mumim. And some of those women are a little bit more extreme than what's described in the parsha. And they said there's a participant in the shir who has a mum the exact same way that is described in the parsha, and inscribed in that gemara in Bechoros. And the question was, so should he read the gemara as is, running the risk of possibly calling attention to this person, or should he skip it, or should he kind of mistranslate it so it won't have that effect? So it's an interesting question in general. Just thought to quickly look at what he discusses here. It's interesting. I don't have to necessarily agree, but just as far as the discussion is concerned, so he talks about here, he says that the Yamshel Shlomo, this is a famous Yamshel Shlomo that everyone quotes. You have to figure out whether or not this is necessarily relevant here. But first off, talks about the Yamshel Shlomo. Yamshel Shlomo was very often invoked in the context of polemics. That Yamshel Shlomo and Bava Kama, for some reason, in general, is a very quoted sefer. Of all the Maharshals, the Yamshel Shlomo Bava Kama seems to be referenced in many different contexts all over the place. But one of the most commented statements is that he has there a statement that it's Yehar V'Yavor to misrepresent the halacha. That he calls a ziyufa Torah, to take the halacha and present it as different than it is, he thinks is Yehari Valyavor. This is a very, very cited source when people get into heated arguments about topics. Yes, sir?
I just quoted that, I think it was the Mitzvah Zev Salvech, why does he protest? I forgot exactly what it was, maybe Reform or something, and then, but he does protest against Zionism, and he said, because one of them is a
Yeah, I think I saw that citation also. Maybe it was in that article we were talking about last week.
Somewhere recently.
But whatever, just again, without getting into the pratim of that. But the idea being that Ziyufa Torah, again, this Marshal is not the only mucker in the matter, but it's a very often cited mucker. And that seems to be his opening premise. He could ask a lot of questions on that mucker. We won't go into all the details. But in any event, he says he thinks that the middle option of mistranslating what the Gemara says is not really an option. He says that you basically have two of the three options. Either you can just say it as is and assume that that's what you need to do, or you can maybe skip it, but to mistranslate it would be wrong. Again, I'm not sure that's the only way to see things, but okay. So then he goes on to quote a very interesting mucker, which we definitely could have discussed last week. It says in the Sefer Chasidim, it's the Tavshin Samaches, quoted in the Magen Avraham, Kuflam and Ches, it's the Kriya Satara. It says, Yizor Achazin Shlo Yikrul Alos Latora, Misha Sumo Be'eno Ha'achas, Parshas Araso Shavar, or Misha Barosho Natak Lakros, Parshas Nisakim. That all of these specific moment, somebody should not get an aliyah for that section in the Torah if he has that moment. Why? Because he will call attention to the fact that he has this mum, and that itself is that's a problem.
What is this?
This is the Sefer Chassidim. Tavshin Samachas. That if a person is speaking to his friend, so he shouldn't look at the place where he has a mum, and he shouldn't speak about that mum that a person has in front of him. So that part, the second part, that you really know already from the halacha of anas tavarim that we'll talk about later in the week, you know, that a person shouldn't draw attention to somebody's aspects that they may be embarrassed about. But this specific application, that one should not give such a person this aliyah, because that will have the effect of calling attention to it, that's particularly striking. So you see from here that you shouldn't call somebody to Kriya Satoru and if when their mum is mentioned, because that will cause them to be embarrassed. And it can make also reference to what it says in the Rashi's Chachma, where it says that a person shouldn't sit, when a person is sitting next to somebody who has a specific mum that embarrasses him, that he should be very careful not to speak about that mum. Even if he's not talking about that specific person, but he's talking about somebody else who has this mum, because the person will consider it a reference to that, and he will consider it to be an embarrassment. However, he says, he thinks there is a distinction to be drawn between our case and the case that the Sefer Chassidim is talking about. In the Sefer Chassidim's case, he says if you're going to davka invite this Baal Mum for an aliyah, where this Mum is mentioned, so that's going to be a straight embarrassment and a blatant embarrassment. Therefore, you should be careful not to do that. However, when the Magid Shir is explaining, as he normally would, the Gemara to the Daf Yomi Shir, so there's no direct embarrassment to the Baal Mum. And therefore, there's basis to say that he shouldn't skip over a portion of the limud because of this concern. He says, to give an example, right, and he says, one of the things you really have to appreciate about Silberstein's writings in general is that while he does have some more unusual types of cases that sometimes seem a little bit beyond what we would consider, but the particular attention that he gives to the Ben Adam L'Chavero components of the Shailas is something that I appreciate very much. So he says that on the one hand, the Sefer Chassidim's case is not exactly comparable to a Magid Shir's case. However, he says here in parentheses, V'lamashal, im chaliwa, he says, if God forbid, what would happen if Yichabed, and he puts Yichabed in quotes, Hamagid Shir es Bal Hamum b'kriyas haketer shemuzka b'mumo, that he's going to have him read the paragraph in which his mum is mentioned. Harezu halbanos panim no ra. That would be a terrible embarrassment. That if he would call on this guy to read that paragraph, that would be an embarrassment that would be along the lines of what the Sefer Chassidim says, and presumably even more blatant. That's why he emphasizes chalila and no ra. It would give even more focus. Ach kasher mamshech hamagid shir l'kro l'tumo. But if the Magid Shir just reads the Gemara innocently, the way it says, and this person happens to be present, so that's not a direct embarrassment. The same way that the Shliach Tzibur, the same way that the Baal Kori laid the parsha this past Shabbos, even if people would be at shul who would have these moments, that Vada ein b'kach habanus panim, Mishum Shleich Daniel was Baal Hamum B'kriya, since he hasn't identified this Baal Mum specifically, so no one pays attention to him directly, that's not going to be an embarrassment. So his assumption is that it's only an issue of Habanas Panim if the person is going to be singled out in some way, either to get an aliyah, or if he's called on to read this passage, that would be even more extreme and focused, and that would be disastrous also. Shabini Donenu, in our case, if you're going to, this is something that Yeah, okay, I was going to say something else. But okay, in this case, if a person is going to hold back from explaining this Gemara, so then you have a loss. You have a loss that this part of the Gemara is not being explained. The Talmud Torah is deficient. And that's a problem. And when you have the Aliyah will be fulfilled by somebody else. So it's a different kind of a cheshbon. That if you don't call up this guy for the Aliyah, somebody else will read the Aliyah. But in our case, it's a little bit worse because it's another difference between the case of the Sefer Hasidim and here. There's two differences. One, the Sefer Hasidim's case, the guy is being singled out, and here he's not being singled out. And the Sefer Hasidim's case, you don't have to give up any Torah. You just get somebody else to get the Aliyah. And here, you're going to skip the Gemara. You're going to be missing something. Then he goes on to say, that when this was suggested in front of Rav Nissim Karelitz, that Rav Nissim Karelitz, who was a well-known posek, a nephew of the Chazon Ish, that he said that you have to know what the person's attitude is, that if you think this is the kind of person who has the kind of emunah, that he'll just see this as the din, reading the Gemara as the halacha, is not going to feel any embarrassment. So then that's one thing. But if it looks like he's going to be offended by these words, so then he would think that's appropriate for the Magid Shir to skip these lines so as not to cause him any insult. And even then he goes on to say, in case you're concerned about this point, that even if the Magid Shir skips these lines, still those who are part of the Shir can make a Siyum Masechta, because since they learned just about every topic in the Gemara and all of its issues, so that's still considered to be a Siyum Masechta. It's a parenthetical issue if you're concerned. If he skips a line, is it justified Siyum? You know, in general, there's an interesting discussion, it's completely tangential, but there's an interesting discussion to be had about what a Siyum requires. That if we talk about a Siyum Masechta today, requires learning the whole Masechta. So the Mishnayos, the Gemaras talk about making a Siyum, and the Gemara, they didn't have the Gemara that we have by definition. They're quoted in the Gemara. So what does it mean if people quoted in the Gemara? What does it mean if they have a Roim to make a Siyum on a Masechta? By definition, they didn't have the same Gemaras that we have. They only had Masechta and Mishnayos. So there's a discussion in Poskim, why shouldn't you be able to learn the Masechta Mishnayos and have it be the same kind of Siyum they made, Maroi made? It's a Siyum on the same Masechta. So there were two approaches that the Sfarim talk about. Some say that, but their learning the Mishnayos included all the Shakla Vataria that they were doing, which later became written down as the Gemara. So therefore, in order to try to evoke the same type of depth of limud that they had when they learned the Mishnayos, we need to actually read the Gemaras in order to have that parallel kind of experience. So his point, just to correlate this point here, he says, okay, so it's not exact that every single printed word that appears in our modern Gemaras has to be included. It means that we really need to learn the Mishnayos with all the Shakla and Tarya that they had at that time. So the our best approximation of that is reading the printed Gemaras that we have. The other approach that they mentioned to differentiate is that simcha shal mitzvah, siyum mitzvah, simcha shal mitzvah, means you feel that simcha when you finish the masechta as it correlates to what you relate to the masechta being. So bismanehem, it was the Mishnayos, and nowadays it is the Mishnayos with the Gemara, and therefore they don't have to ask, well, what about if there are censored texts in the Gemara? Is there things that we don't have, the words that we're missing? Okay, whatever it is that we perceive Maseches Bav Metzia to be, that's the siyum. Hi.
What about a
Siman Tanakh? Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about that, where he writes that if somebody learned a Sefer of Tanakh seriously with Mefarshim, and it was a real project, and he finishes that Sefer, then he thinks that that's also right for a Siman. So clearly there's some subjectivity here. It has to reach a certain level of accomplishment, and you have to figure out what rises to that level, but that's what Rav Moshe assumes, that theoretically within Tanakh, you could have the same kind of thing if it was something that really rose to that level in terms of the studies he writes as a fortune, and it was a serious project. You know, it was
why finished. Not? People do see them on Gemara for Bikita, so why not?
Right, so that's where I think his point is, that it's somewhat subjective, that we have to figure out what rises to the level of an extensive accomplishment that when you finish it, you feel simcha. So masechtas in general are such a big deal that a person puts in enough effort to learn all the lot in a certain masechta, even if he did it pekiyas wise, has reached that level of simcha, and Tanakh maybe reads a little bit more quickly. So in order for it to rise to that level, if it was a more intense limud and people really took it seriously and they put effort into it and they really accomplished learning the whole sefer seriously, then that could be considered a siyum as well. Hi.
So would that be, I guess, in accordance with that famous story with him where he told the guy to make a siyum only one block of Gemara or something like that?
I don't know that story.
There's a guy who's like a Baal Tshuva, and he was learning with some guy, and you know, they went to Ramosha, he learned his first block of Gemara, and he was like so happy, and Ramosha told him, I think he told him to make a siyum, but they had some stories about that.
Yeah.
So I mean, it makes sense. You know, the point is that perhaps the scale should change depending on... Right, so you know, that's probably true. It's just it happens to be... So when we have the Siyum, that Ramatir thing, like Erev Pesach and the 9 days, so we want to have some type of standard, some type of objective standards. That's what we usually talk about. You know, one of the Rav's most famous drushas was written up in English. It was published in a journal, in a one-time journal that Hamavasar published. It was one of his very, very famous drushas in the love of Torah. It's called Impromptu Remarks at a Siyum. So the Siyum that they were having, I don't think it was relevant to being Matar Basar B'Yayin or reading on Erev Pesach, but they were having a Siyum and they asked him to speak and his words became memorialized and became a very famous drasha. But that Siyum was on a parak of Chulim, if I remember correctly. So presumably, you know, they were only learning a parak of Gemara, but the depth that they learned it and the rigor that was involved, it was worthy of a party, even though it didn't qualify for what we normally consider an Erev Pesach or 9 days. You know. So clearly there is some subjectivity here. And any major project in learning is that's accomplished is a simcha shel mitzvah. So this is completely tangential to this point, but basically what he's trying to say is that it's not going to take away if you skip a line, so you're not going to offend somebody. You shouldn't think that the people in the shir can no longer make a siyum on this mesechta. It's not the case. So he said that the psak from Nissan Karelitz is that it depends, you have to be able to assess the people who were there. That if you think that, and sometimes this is the case, but you really have to know who you're dealing with, that if the person is just going to see this as a din in the Torah and he's going to have the emunah to be able to relate to this as simple halacha, not something that causes him any embarrassment because nobody's really doing anything to him and he's not doing anything embarrassing, it's just that the din is being read in the subjective truth. So that would be ideal if that's the attitude, so then great. But if you're not so sure that's the attitude and you think the person may indeed feel embarrassed and looked at, sometimes also I think you probably have to worry that, you know, I don't think it would be true in this room, but let's say if you're teaching high school students and maybe the Rebbe should have to be concerned that he'll say something and the other students will say something inappropriate because they're provoked by that din. So let's say if you were learning Bechoros with a high school group and or a group of people who you don't necessarily have the right level of maturity to handle it properly. So perhaps the students will all of a sudden say, oh, yeah, and start pointing to the student. So then if that's likely to happen, the Rebbe should be careful not to allow that to happen. So this is gonna be a subjective assessment, which this kind of correlates to what we've spoken about Lashon Hara recently a little bit, that there is a certain subjectivity in the assessment that needs to be very carefully assessed by the people who are involved. So then he quotes here a psak from the Das Torah. This is a well-known psak that the Rav Shlomo Shvadron and his Hakdamba to the Sefer Das Torah, which is a likut of Psakim, and not just a likut, but a commentary on Shulchan Aruch, that gives an example of a chassid shote. That, you know, Gemara in Sota talks about a chassid shote, about somebody who thinks he's being pious, he's a chassid, but he's acting with shtus, he's acting foolishly. So the Gemara talks about somebody who refuses to save a drowning woman because he says it's not sadua to save a drowning woman, so he'll let her drown instead. So that's a chassid shote. So here he gives another example of a chassid shote. Somebody thought he was so frum, so he was among a group of people and he saw somebody that had a certain physical defect. So he says, oh, I have an opportunity to make a bracha of Mishana Habrios. So, Barovam Hadras Melech. So he grabs the guy and he says, remember my uncle Moshe used to jokingly talk about people who want to make Mishana Brios a la coast, you know, want to really call attention to Mishana Brios, and he ended up humiliating this person. So the Marsham quotes this as an example of the Chassid Shavuot. A person thinks he's doing a mitzvah, and he thinks he's doing a mitzvah behider, and of course he's creating terrible embarrassment. And he adds here the same for the wine. Oylo l'chassid shota zeh sh'hafach mitzvah l'ritzicha. Merov sechlusa yibay b'mitzvaso as chelka ba'ol. Here, woe is to this chassid shota who turned a mitzvah into murder, because right? We consider halbanos b'nechav ever avim like murder. And out of his great foolishness, he lost, through his quote-unquote mitzvah, he lost his chelka in olam haba. So that's clearly not indicated, and that's the pasuk that we read last week in the context of Tochacha, which is also a mitzvah. But at the same time, the Gemara says that the pasuk should be read that if the Tochacha creates Almanus Pnei Chaver Barabim, that's the rest of the pasuk for Lo Siso Al Chait, that through the mitzvah you should do a terrible Avera, that would be Geferlech. So, yes, the story here also that one of the Mashkichim told the story that one of the great Mitzianim in the yeshiva was Nebuchadnezzar accident. And he injured his leg. He became limp. And this fact that he became a balmum, so to speak, caused him tremendous tsar, that he wasn't able to learn the way he was before. So they took him to one of the homes of one of the Gedolei Yisrael in order to give him some chizuk. It took many Gedolim, and after he visited many Gedolim, so they took him to the house of Rav Michal Yehuda Lefkowitz, Rosh Hashiva Zir Mpanovich, passed away a few years ago, not so long ago, relatively recently. That's already Zatzal in the Sefer, so when it was published, also pretty recently. But Kishtapari to the Rosh Hashiva, Odos Mitzkasal Shalabach, when he told him his kid's issues, so he hugged him, and he took his hands, and he said to him, your Torah will protect you, and will guard you. You should continue to work hard in learning, and you will become a gadol b'Torah. And he continued to talk to his heart, and all of a sudden, this bacher realized that warm water is dripping on his fingers, and he realizes that these are the tears of the Rosh Hashiva. So the Rosh Hashiva felt so passionately about his situation that this had such an effect on the bacher that this had a total spinning around of his attitude, and he himself burst out into tears, and he continued his learning in Lakewood, and Baruch Hashem, he went out to Lakewood in America and continued his learning, and Baruch Hashem, he became very, very successful, and he became a tremendous Ben Aliyah. And after 3 years, he came back to Eretz Yisrael and he got married. And when they met at a simcha, he said to this mashgiach, he says, I just want to say that all of these words of Rav Michal Yehuda had a tremendous effect, and I still remember them, and they continue to support me and to inspire me in my learning. Okay, so that's a kind of a footnote to this point. But essentially, I think this discussion is very interesting, and it ties together last week's Shani, this week's Shani, and Hazav, that the concern for Halbanos Pnei Chaver Barabim theoretically could extend even to learning, even to discussion of the Sugya, and the Sefer Chassidim's pack is very interesting regarding the Aliyah, and the possible differences, and then the basic conclusion that the person has to be careful, the Rebbe has to be careful to try to assess what exactly are the scenarios, what exactly is relevant in terms of possibly embarrassing somebody. Okay, so now for a few minutes, instead of talk about Nekima Natira. So I think we alluded to it a little bit, but just, it's again one of the Psukim and Shani and Parshas Kedoshim. So the Torah has two Isurim, Lo Sikom Velo Sitor Espenei Amacha, which would translate as, do not take revenge and do not bear a grudge regarding the members of your nation. So what does that mean, take revenge or bear a grudge? So if you think about it, on the surface, it sounds like something very dramatic, vigilante justice. A guy puts on a ski mask and goes after with a machine gun after everybody who's given him a hard time. And it's vengeance. But that's not what the Gemara explains. The Gemara in Maseches Yuma tells us that it means something much more mundane. Now, let's say I ask Michael, to lend me his MP3 recorder. And he says, no, he's not interested. Okay, fine. So then the next day he asks me to lend him some sneakers. And I say, why should I lend you sneakers? You wouldn't lend me what I wanted yesterday. So says the Gemara, that's a violation of Loisikum. The question, Deb? So then what's Loisitor? What does it mean to bear a grudge? It's basically the same scenario, except that I said to him, I will lend you the sneakers, because I'm not a jerk like you. You wouldn't lend me property yesterday. I'm much nicer than you. Here you go. See what it means to be a nice guy. Take the sneakers. So those cases are very mundane. I mean, it's not exactly the dramatic kind of revenge and grudge-bearing that we would think about. And in fact, the Gemara seems to suggest, and actually I'm remembering why we spoke about this a little bit, because it came up when we were talking about Tarumas in the beginning of the semester, what exactly is the definition of Tarumas. So you may recall some of this from there, that the Gemara says that if it's a tzaira de gufa, if it's a personal suffering, rather than what we just described, which is considered to be a monetary issue, because it's about property, but if it's a tzaira de gufa, so then actually it should be permitted to take revenge or bear a grudge, but still not recommended. Still, we say that kalamavra midosav mochul kalavanosav, that whoever can forgive, everything gets forgiven for him. And as Rashi Rosh Hashanah explains, mavra midosav means that a person's able to not keep score. Midosav means measurements. A person who keeps track of how he was offended and says, I have to make sure to pay back everyone to the same degree that they hurt me. So that's the person who's keeping score. And who's ever willing to not do that, to be able to forget about keeping score, so then he will be privileged to the same type of treatment from God. God will forgive him from everything. If you think about it, it's a very powerful thought. It's very compelling. Because you think about it, davening in Yom Kippur. And imagine you could talk directly to a Kadosh Baruch Hu and you say, God, please forgive me for everything I did this year. And then God says to you, but you're not forgiving your friends for what he did to you. And you'll say, wow, what he did is really bad. I can't expect me to forgive him, but God, you should forgive me. So it's clearly a very incongruous message. So if you really think about it, just imagine you're having a face-to-face conversation with God with a back and forth. You could see how this interferes with your own ability to get Mechil on Yom Kippur, the kind of picture that it paints. So the Gemara understands that connection and says that if you want to be somebody who is forgiven, to have an attitude of forgiveness towards others is certainly helpful to your cause when you make your case in front of a Kadosh Baruch
Hu. Hi. I'm trying to think of a specific example that would help reinforce my question, but I mean, at least for myself, I don't know if other people do this also. Like, sometimes I'll like say, so, like, somebody will ask me something, like, yeah, it's not like you did, like, so, like, is there any, like, keeping scores like a joke? You're not really mockbit on it, but it's kind of like, whatever, like, I'm trying to think.
I think I know what you're getting at. You have to figure out what you mean. Do you mean it really is a joke?
It really is a joke. We know that sometimes, it's not.
Right, but sometimes people do it the other way around. They are pretending it is a joke when it's not. So if that's what you mean,
no, I mean the other way.
So if you mean it's really a joke and everyone's past it, so then a joke is a joke. But if a joke is a veiled way of actually saying what you want to say seriously but pretending it's a joke, which is often the case, so then that's something to, and often is taken as the case. So that's something that you want to think about.
Okay, usually the opposite.
Well, sometimes it is the opposite, but sometimes you have to know whether it is or isn't. And you also have to know how the other person is going to take it. But it also itself addresses another interesting issue within this topic. Maybe we'll get to it in a second. But in any event, the Gemara says, Betty, you should be mochel. And the Gemara says that those who Kadosh Baruch Hu really loves, Kitzeis HaShemesh B'Gvuraso, like the sun in its strength, people who can be insulted and don't insult back, people who have their honor attacked and they don't feel a need to respond, those people are really on God's good side. That's a great place to be. So we recommend not taking revenge, even if it's a personal suffering, says the Gemara, unless it is the honor of a Talmud Chacham. And the Gemara has a statement there, very difficult to understand. The kol tamur chacham she'eno nokim v'noter kenachash she'eno tamur chacham. If a tamur chacham doesn't take the common material like a Nachash, who's not considered to be a Talmud Chacham. And so the Gemara says that that means really that he lets other people do it and he doesn't involve himself, but he lets it happen because of the Kavod HaTorah. That comparison to a Nachash is a very interesting comparison. Hard to know exactly what it means. Many, many Mefarshim say that it doesn't mean that it's vicious. It means the opposite. It means that just like a Nachash, we find in Parshas Bereishis, eats the dirt, and that's how he sustains himself, but there's no hana in eating dirt. So too, it's necessary to act the Kavod HaTorah, but you're not going to get any hana from it. You're not going to get any pleasure from that reaction. If you're on some Eibshitz, went a step further, and he said that it's just like in a snake that bites, a venomous snake that bites, so it puts its poison in, but it itself gets weakened if it does that. So too, the Talmud Chacham will have to respond because it's Kavod HaTorah, but he's not going to feel any personal hana, and in fact, he'll feel weaker. So, this is an interesting idea. The Gemara has this scenario, which is much more mundane than we would think, and then seems to say that if it's a real issue, so then you're allowed to take revenge or bear a grudge. And indeed, we saw that that's how some understood the concept of Tarumus in our parak was about basically bearing a grudge. And some said it was based on this idea that the Gemara has, that personal suffering, you're allowed to bear a grudge. So we questioned that interpretation, if you remember. This is a good chazara from that point. Because, first of all, if there is such a heter, then it should apply to taking revenge also, not just bearing a grudge, because they're mentioned together. But it's not clear that there is such a heter or that it's a recommended heter. It should be for some type of toelis. It's not clear what toelis bearing a grudge has in that case. And it's clear from the Gemara and from later sources that this heter is somewhat shaky. Because, first of all, the Gemara clearly discourages it. But also, not all Rishonim acknowledge it. So the Rambam and the Sefer HaChinuch don't acknowledge such a distinction. So how do they have the license to disagree with the Gemara? So two components to that question. First of all, textually. So it's possible that the Rambam had a different gears than the Gemara. That doesn't distinguish between Sire de Mamona and Sire de Gufa, but rather talks about Mule Daum and Mule de Shmai. It says that this world kind of stuff, you shouldn't take revenge. But stuff that's Kvod Shamayim, like our Gemara does say, that's an area where you can take revenge. There are others, perhaps, point to different Midrashim that have different Gersa, so it could be there's enough textual basis for the Rambam of the Paskin, like something other than this Gemara. But also Al Pi Svara, the Rambam and the Chinuch have different Svaras, which could also reflect reasons not to distinguish. So the Rambam, for example, the Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvahs talks about this. And there's a good question you could ask in the Sefer Yad HaKatana notes, that isn't the Torah full of revenge? Not just about God taking revenge, but isn't it telling us many times that we should take revenge? So you talk about kefil, right? That's not just restitution, that's going above and beyond. You talk about Eid Zomim, Kasha Zomim, Lasso, that's all, isn't that all basically vengeance? So the Yad HaKatana says, and the Rambam sounds like this himself, that this is basically the point. That the Torah tells us there are some issues that are serious. If somebody tries to kill you with false testimony in Beis Din, that's pretty serious. If somebody steals your stuff, that's serious. So we have a justice system that's there to address that. But everything below these thresholds where the Torah tells us there's a system, so the message by inference is that these things are not worth paying attention to and getting worked up about, and therefore one should forget about them, one should move on. Otherwise, if you're not going to forget about them, you're going to get all worked up, so then you're going to continue having a feud forever, and that becomes the Hatfields and the McCoys. You're going to take revenge for this, and then the other person will take revenge for your revenge, and then you'll take revenge back for their revenge, and it'll go on for generations. And that's going to destroy the world. That's going to be very bad for Kiyum Ha'olam, says the Rambam. Some have a gerus in the Rambam, Kiyum Ha'aretz. It's interesting. What does that mean, Kiyum Ha'aretz specifically? Or Yishuv Ha'aretz, something like that. Yishuv Ha'olam, Yishuv Kiyum, Yishuv, forget which. So some want to suggest that maybe he says Yishuv Ha'aretz as in Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, because the Gemara says they went into Galus because of Sinas Chino. So if we're trying to avoid Sinas Chino, so keeping track of everything is what's going to lead to Sinas Chino. So he says Yishuv Haaretz, meaning Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, is going to be affected by bearing a grudge and taking revenge. But he probably means the world falls apart, society collapses if everyone's going to do this. So if that's the idea, you could understand why we're not going to be machalic. It's not going to make a difference if we're talking about Tzair D'Gufer and Tzair D'Amon, any issue that's not significant for you to focus on it, to bear a grudge, is going to lead to major problems. It's going to lead to the world falling apart. The Sefer Achinuch, who also doesn't make such a distinction, he has his own hesber. And why there's an Isra. And that's actually very relevant also to the Bechukosai, to the Tochacha. And the Sefer Achinuch says that the reason we shouldn't take revenge or bear a grudge is because everything bad that happens in this world, it happens for a reason. What the reason is, who knows? Maybe it's an Onesh, maybe it's a Gamzla Tova, maybe it's a Nisonim, whatever the reason is. The bad things that happen, happen for a reason. And for us to become obsessed with saying, oh, it happened because of him, because it's his fault, that's going to be a distraction. That's going to take us away from whatever we need to get out of this, to, out of this message. A rabbi, I saw his correspondence recently, so he has his signature and his email as a quotation. It says, nothing ever goes away until it's taught you what you need to learn. Whatever is going on in this world is there to make some points. And if you're going to keep saying it's here because of that guy is the cause of all my problems, you're never going to learn what you need to learn. It's not going to be productive. So to focus on the human shliach for your suffering is a bad idea, which is what taking revenge and bearing a grudge necessarily entails. And again, if that's the hesber, so then you can see why there's no distinction that's really relevant between that which is mili d'alma and that which is mili d'shmaya. This is perhaps relevant also, we'll talk about the Tochacha, so there's different versions of the same idea in Chukosai and Kisavo. The Torah says something along the lines of the Nasta and the Enrodev, that one of the things that will happen is that you are going to run away and there's nobody chasing you. And it's a hard pasuk to understand because isn't that better than the alternative? And one thing that you want, if you're running away, if you could ask who would you most likely answer to be in terms of who's chasing you, if it turns out to be nobody, that's probably the best answer. Right? That's not really a very scary ending to the dramatic moment in the scary movie. You hear the sounds of the chasing. Who is it? No one. That's not really scary.
It's for the sequel.
Right, for the sequel. Right? So what does it mean there's no one chasing you? So I thought the pshat was similar to what the Sefer Achinuch was saying, that people suffer in life. And very often you'll have people whose suffering is on the surface associated because it was somebody's fault. Somebody did something, somebody was negligent, somebody committed a crime, whatever it is. But if other people have the same suffering that's not attributable to anybody's negligence, it was because of an accident, or because of a heart attack, or because of whatever, you can't blame it on anyone, they're still suffering the same way. But nonetheless, people get psychological release by being able to say that it's his fault, and I can sue that guy, or I can put that guy in jail. That somehow makes their suffering alleviated a little bit. So it's not really relevant. The suffering is the same either way. Whether or not there's a human person you can blame it on, if the result is there's a certain loss, there's a certain damage, the suffering is going to be the same no matter what. Right, just because we were talking about that example on Sefer, so let's say that boy with a leg that's damaged, the boy with a broken leg. So that could have happened in an accident. It could have happened because somebody was negligent, or it could have happened because somebody was criminal. So in one case, he could sue somebody, in one case, he could put somebody in jail, and in one case, there's nobody to blame. But in all three cases, he has the same problem. He still has the same damaged leg, no matter what. His suffering shouldn't really make a difference. But just the idea that you can blame somebody for it, that gives people somewhat of an attitude that, okay, I can at least alleviate my suffering that way. So especially in the context of the Tovah, if you're saying that you're going to suffer, you're going to be running away. And there's no rodef. You can't find any human pursuer to say it's his fault, to say that's the reason I'm running away. So that itself is something that will make the tochacha more direct, to realize it's just between you and God, and that's perhaps a relevant message. So I think that's what the Sefer HaChinuch is saying, that whatever happens in life, we're not meant to focus on any human intermediary, but rather on the event itself. So it makes sense for the Sefer HaChinuch that you're not going to distinguish between Sairi Degufa and Sairi Dumamon. Now, other Rishonim, like the Sefer Yireim and others, do pass on like the Gemara. So, how do you understand why the Gemara focuses on that example specifically? So, the Sefer Yireim basically says, as others do as well, that if you look at the context of the Torah, it's right here of Yahavta L'Reyach and Kamocha, which we interpret at least. Had time to go into this. This is another partial topic that we haven't been able to really examine. But that we have to reach a kamocha is possibly the mitzvah of chesed, that we should be kind to people and do things for people. So maybe you might say, okay, I should help out people with chesed if they'll help me out. But if they're not going to help me out, so then why should I be involved in helping anyone else out? So the Torah is basically saying that you shouldn't take an attitude that this person doesn't deserve a chesed because he's not a baal chesed himself. So just to mention one or two nafkaminas and then I'll let you go. So the different approaches. So there's a discussion in Sefer Paras Yosef. He quotes a few halachic discussions. Paras Yosef and Chumash. So one case that's relevant, let's say you have an apartment building with very thin walls. So you could hear that your neighbor asks a different neighbor, if he hit through the walls, if he could borrow his MP3 player, and the neighbor says no. And then that neighbor who says no, now he comes to your house and wants to borrow something. So should you say that, well, I know he doesn't want to lend other people stuff, so I don't want to lend him stuff? So if the issue is that you're bearing a grudge because you're keeping score, so this guy didn't do anything to you. You don't have any issue with him, you're just assessing that he's not worthy of your attention. But according to some Rishonim, that's the whole issue of the human tier to begin with. To decide a person only deserves chesed if he'll himself give chesed. So to say, even though it involves a third party, maybe that's an issue. And just to mention another case, let's say you have two people who come to you at the same time. They both want to borrow this item that you have, and you only have one. One of them is somebody who you have no issues with, your friend. And the other person is somebody who refused to help you out the day before. So now it's legitimate to say, well, at least I should prefer the guy who is nice to me. I'm not trying to actively take revenge on the guy who didn't help me, but I can only lend it to one person. I might as well give it to the person who does help me. Or maybe the Sfar, to say the opposite, maybe the Sfar, the Dav could give it to the not nice guy. What's this far? I think we talked about it recently.
Maybe he'll he'll change his mind and start being nice to you.
Right, that before he'll start being nicer to him, that basically by giving to him, that will address issues that you have with him that we find the Torah has in what context? You have Tino Frika, Hamor Sonacha. We talked about this a little bit on Thursday, that if you have somebody who you don't get along with, maybe Davka is an idiot to be a Baal Chesed towards that person even more, because that will improve the relationship. I saw once the Sefer Ariyach Kamocha had an interesting point. The Chafetz Chaim says in Avos Chesed that the priorities that we find by Tzedaka, like Aviyah Yerchei Kodmim, presumably apply to Chesed as well. It's a parallel kind of idea. So therefore, when it comes to Chesed, you should do Chesed to people who are closest to you rather than prioritizing people who are far away. So in the Sefer Ariyach Kamocha, so he notes, based on this, he says one svar to do that is because chesed, in addition to its other mitzvah components, also helps society function better. People get along better when they're engaged with chesed towards each other. So if that's the case, so we see from this notion of chamor sonecha that you'll be more likely to be getting along better with people who you do chesed for. So therefore it makes sense that people who you interact with most, the people who you're neighbors, those are the people with whom you should have an even greater engagement of chesed with. All right, there's more to say about this, but the time is short. I have a question.
It's kind of flipping the what we're saying. If you're like a lawyer, for instance, and you're asked to represent a murderer, like who's like, yeah, everybody knows he's a murderer. Since, I guess from a halachic standpoint, like, he didn't do, like, he murdered somebody, so why should he be entitled to a fair trial?
Well, it depends what you mean. There's all kinds of gradations and nuances. You know, a fair trial is what that's what everyone's entitled to, and the Torah has such a concept as well in some pretty striking ways. We find in the Gemara that people are entitled to a vigorous defense, even if they are people who are accused of very serious things. It becomes more complicated if you have to do something that is going to tilt things unfairly in his favor, or going to misrepresent things. But the idea that people who are accused of serious crimes are entitled to a vigorous defense, so that's a different question, and that's something which the Gemara itself has some pretty striking examples. Probably the Gemara also says, for example, that a dayan who sees somebody kill someone, who sees it with his own eyes, so he cannot be a dayan, ain't it nice to dayan? And one of the reasons the Gemara considers is because it's part of the dayanim's job to be able to consider all the defenses for the defendant, and since he saw it happen, he's going to have a very hard time being an effective defense advocate, so we exclude him. Pretty striking idea if you think about it. So in halacha, we find that idea as well. It really opens up some other issues. Hi.
To what extent do you think that the benefit of the doubt?
Yeah, that was actually something we talked about on Thursday also. We talked about the dam l'chav z'chus. So we discussed that dam l'chav z'chus, for the most part, al pi halacha, really only applies in reasonable cases. That's how the Rabbi Yonah and the Chafetz Chaim understood it. But we considered the question of, let's acknowledge that it's only obligatory in those cases. But what if you could do more? Let's say you're creative enough, you can stretch your imagination enough that you could impose a positive spin on something that most people would find unreasonable. So if it's a danger that's going to happen because we're downplaying somebody's risk, so then for sure that's not a good idea, and that's the opposite of what you should do. Well, let's assume there's no risk to anybody else. It's just a question of judging this person, and it's hard to do so honestly in a way that's positive. Is there a value to it? It's definitely not required. Is there a value to it or not? So we discussed it. That was my focus we showed him. And we suggested that it depends on what the point of Dam L'chav z'chus is. That if it's about maintaining social standards, so then that really only applies to the average person. But if it's an idea that you're trying to harmonize society by having as little suspicion as possible, so if you're able to extend generosity of spirit even above and beyond what the average person could do, then ma tov ma noy. But everyone agrees that it's not required. At that point. All right, so we will end there. Again, tomorrow we will continue with Poland and try to get as much done in the next 3 days. Maybe just tell you one story.